And we are live.
Another Friday, another week.
Yeah, I was thinking actually just before the show started that maybe we should commit to a single time every week and just go for it no matter what. Does that make a difference to people's listening schedules? I mean, I'm not hugely into listening to live podcasts, so I don't really know.
At the same time, it's where in our new reality, everyone is always at home.
Right. There's not really any commuting time to take into account anymore.
Nope.
But I just don't know how much people, I guess, take those routines into account when they choose podcasts. If you have something to say on that or any feedback, feel free to email us at tips@9to5g.com. Which actually ties into something Abner and I were talking about before the show, which is that we unfortunately can't have 9to5 Google on G Suite. So that's why our tips line is 9to5g.com, in case anyone's wondering. So this week, we are going to talk about Apple stuff a lot. I mean, we're not going to solely talk about Apple stuff, but we are going to talk about some Apple stuff, but more in the context of what it means for Google and what it means in the context of what Google's done in the past. We tend to do this every year on WWDC week. So if you don't care at all about Apple and you're that tribalistic about your platforms, no judgment, but if you're that person, then this might be an episode you want to skip.
Yeah, those are the people that love to know what phone you tweet from.
I don't need to say what phone I tweet from most often, but it is comedic when someone I criticize Apple or something and on Twitter, and someone says, "You know, you don't have to be so tribalistic about which platforms you like," because you know half of the people that follow me think that I'm a diehard Android fan that has no tolerance for anything Apple, and then the other half assume that I am a fake Google fan and that I only use iOS and Apple products. So there's no winning in these polarizing times.
Absolutely not.
And I think the political polarization has only transcended to technology too. That's a whole rabbit hole to go down. Let's just talk about what happened at WWDC and kind of talk about what it means in relation to what Google's already done. I mean, I wrote a piece this week titled "With iOS 14, Apple Embraces Smartphone UX Decisions That Google Made a Decade Ago." And people rightly, I think, critiqued that headline saying, hey, no, it's not Android that made these decisions. It was Windows Phone. And, you know, there's some truth to that. I mean, I think it's hard to take Windows Phone into account when it's completely irrelevant in modern times.
Yeah, it's... History is the winners judge history.
Yeah,
or
right.
White exactly. Final history.
Right. But yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I don't think Android has really taken Windows Phone. To be honest, it's just they strongly had different ideas at around the same time when everyone was innovating on the smartphone. And yes, the market share and the carrier partnerships played a role in it, and the app ecosystems, obviously. But at the end of the day, there was a clear winner.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me that some of these features that Apple added with iOS 14 are things that, and this was basically the central point of my piece, was every single year, you know, Apple copies Google, and conversely, Google. I mean, maybe not as much. I don't know. It's debatable, arguable. But Google tends to copy Apple as well. Like at Google I.O., you know, there's usually a handful of features that Apple managed to get to first that Google is just saying me too about. And vice versa, at WWDC, Apple's typically, you know, I think that happens generally more often with Apple that Apple is just saying us too, because Apple is the more conservative of the two in terms of their adoption of new ideas. And just broadly speaking, I mean, Apple can be extremely innovative in its own ways when it sees an opportunity to, but I think when it comes to its iterative software updates, it tends to be a little bit more on the conservative side and making sure that certain features are exactly the experience that they want them to be before they turn them into something that ships to everyone. And that just could not have been the case more than it has ever been this year, at least in my opinion. I think Apple, I mean, as I said, the central point of my piece was basically these features that Apple added, at least the most visible of them, which are pretty much widgets in the app library. Those are the kind of the home screen changes that Apple's changing, which, you know, Apple has not really changed home screen hardly at all since the first versions of iOS. And these are pretty big changes. And these happen to be changes or features that Android has had since literally day one. Home screen widgets, the ability to put interactive elements that tie into your third-party apps on your home screen, you actually looked into it and figured out which version of Android was it. It was like
Android 1.5 Cupcake, the one that introduced on the G1, I believe.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, if we want to consider the G1 as kind of the advent of Android, which it pretty much was, there was a handful of different phones that kind of fell into that category. But, you know, I think that just shows how fundamental this feature has been to the decisions that Google made about what it means to use a smartphone. And clearly they believed early on that having these little interactive widgets on your home screen was going to be a pretty important piece of the smartphone experience. And I don't know, I think, would you say Android widgets have kind of fallen by the wayside over the last several years? I think there was kind of a glory days of them around Android 5.0, maybe 6.0, where everyone's homes were filled with kind of useful widgets, and there was definitely a lot of home screen experiences, comparisons and stuff, and people sharing screenshots of what their widget customized home screens looked like, and all the Apple iOS people on the other side were kind of jealous of that. There was kind of a heyday, right? And then since fallen off.
I forgot which version the original Nexus 7 launched with, but I definitely remember loving the idea of widgets and being able to see so much more information, to have Android feel so much more alive, so to speak, as an operating system that's updating and active and vibrant just from the home screen experience. So there was definitely a time when widgets were all the rage. Honestly, a big part of it was like the defaults that that carriers, that HTC, everybody knows that iconic giant HTC clock with the weather underneath. And for a long time, that was the look of the operating system. Like every home screen had that widget with the HTC devices when they were very relevant. So they had a heyday. They were a design playground, to borrow another phrase. They looked wild. They could do a lot. I think quite a few people had, when Google Now was still in its heyday too, they had that default Google Now widget, and the weather, people love having the weather on the home screens, and those staples they existed for a long time. Definitely like during the ICS, the ice cream sandwich days, Marshmallow, I'd probably give them up to that.
Yeah. And even today, those parts of the widget experience are still fundamental to Android. I mean, look at all of the Pixel phones and the Pixel launcher, and how it's very core to the Pixel launcher experience that it has the weather and the time and quick access to your calendar. And that's pretty much, that's pretty much what people have used widgets for on Android. There's obviously, all third-party apps have in one way or another add their own, little widgets that it may have been useful to people in very niche use cases. I remember for our job, we're constantly tracking our AdSense revenue on various things, or our Google Analytics or whatever. And those apps used to have, maybe they still do have, Android widgets that, could give you glanceable information, that core data that you're always keeping track of for work or whatever, right on your home screen. So those have always,
That glanceability was just so cool to what made Android feel like a different operating system during the early days of the OS wars. And Yeah, they are still crucial, though personally, I only have one widget on my home screen right now, and it's for Pocket Cast to access quick controls. And sometimes I have a music widget too, but yeah, it's not as vibrant, it's not as busy, the widgets being a thing that people wanted. Though what comes to mind is when Spotify removed their music player widget, and there was absolute outrage that forced them to bring it back. And their argument was something along the lines of, yeah, the widget is getting old. They didn't spend any time on updating the widget through the recent design languages or something like that. And yeah, they just brought back the old one.
Yeah, and it'll certainly get some love now. That's one of the interesting side effects of this is going to be that now that developers are pouring in, I mean, pretty much anytime Apple launches some kind of core functionality to iOS, it kind of in the iOS developer community seems to be kind of like a, if you aren't taking advantage of the new APIs and you aren't designing around Apple's functionality, then you're kind of, you know, a black sheep. You know, like it's kind of like you have to take advantage of what the platform is offering, or else, you know, you're kind of, I don't know, you're not really creating the full kind of iOS experience. And obviously, as we know, developers on iOS tend to be, I guess I should say the apps or startups or companies tend to pour more money and funds into actually building out those iOS apps because they tend to be where the money comes from. And so I think one of the interesting side effects of this is going to be that there's going to be kind of a renaissance of a rebirth of Android widgets, because as a side effect of these developers pouring effort into the iOS apps or the iOS apps and widgets, they're going to, you know, have to now build out, I guess it makes sense to kind of just, if both platforms offer the same feature as they do with every other thing in the app, you know, just build out the same functionality for both platforms.
Yeah. On Google's first party iOS app situation, I have to say it's pretty one-to-one. I'm looking right now at Chrome. Chrome has one, Assistant, Calendar. There's a whole lot for Maps, Google Keep, YouTube Music, that kind of stuff. So it'll be interesting to see Google's first party apps, to speak about them directly, update their experiences, and then seeing how that translates over to Android for the benefit of everybody.
Yeah. Well, widgets were only really the tip of the iceberg when it came to the ways in which iOS 14 is similar to fundamental Android features. I mean, another thing was the app library, which basically now iOS is now allowing you to hide all of your home screens that have cluttered apps that you don't really use very often and just quickly access what is, I mean, in effect, a smarter or differently organized version of the app drawer. I mean, that seems like it's basically what that is. I mean, right? Like,
yeah, apps. Yeah, it's visual. To me, it's visually confusing in that it's, so you go to your app library and then there's an extra layer of organization in Apple putting it in a too wide grid. So that's right. It's a bit busy, but they're adding more customization. But I think the key point that differentiates this app library and widgets actually is how much Apple is interested in. They added these two UI paradigms because they want to organize the experience on the behalf of users. The place they're coming from is very interesting, and to like simplify the UI, the UX for end users. So it ends up with features like smart stacks for widgets, which basically shows you the right widget for the time of day, which is something that you could imagine Google doing, and they are doing with apps in Android 11. And this app library automatically organizes your apps based on relevance and frequency. And it's just these kind of smarts that you expect Google to be doing, and they are doing.
Yeah, and actually, Apple is doing pretty much exactly what Google did with app suggestions and the Pixel launcher, which is there's actually, I don't know if you heard about this yet, and I don't think it was mentioned in the keynote, but there's actually a Siri suggestions widget that you can add to your home screen that is just an app grid. It's a 4x2 app grid, so it's 8 apps, and it is just Siri suggestion apps that you can have on your home screen, and those 8 apps are just dynamically updating all the time based on which app the system thinks that you're about to use. And that's basically just in the Pixel launcher, you've been able to, have those 5 app suggestions that, are just constantly being updated and dynamically. This is that, but just it's 8 apps and it's on your home screen. It's the exact same experience, I think. So,
mm-hmm. So before we weave these two topics, I want to jump into a tweet that you had earlier. I'm just going to read it since it's very concise. It's not even a question in my mind whether Google will breathe new life into widgets and reinvent the app drawer with Android 12. So jumping off that, what do you think of, how do you compare the organizations? Yes, we haven't had the chance to use the iOS 14 stuff yet, but comparing it to what Android is today, what do you think?
I think one thing that Apple's doing right that the app drawer can learn from is that the actual scrollable list of apps in the iOS, I guess I'll just call it the app drawer, it's the app library, is one more tap away, right? So if you're on iOS and you have, let's say you've hidden all of your app pages and you just swipe right to go to the app library, and then it's one tap away, you tap the top, and then suddenly you've got, your letters on the right side of the screen that allow you to quickly scroll through the entire full list of apps that are installed on the device. Mm-hmm. I think we'll see the app drawer evolve into something like that, where the centerpiece of the experience is intelligent suggestions and the full list part of the experience is maybe another tap away. I think that makes sense. I think it makes sense to go that direction. And I think that Apple probably has extensive, they have not changed. This is part of the reason I think this is just because I'm imagining that there's extensive user studies that have been done on Apple's part, because they haven't changed the home screen in 15 years almost. So I imagine that if they're making a change and they decided to do the app library this way, I imagine they have substantive data to suggest that this is actually better than just offering, a swipe right, which goes straight to a full list, which would effectively be a functional replication of the app drawer on Android. I think they have probably extensive data to show that this system, and I'm not saying that Google would design it the same way, but this system of app suggestions being the forefront of the experience, which in Apple's case is a bunch of boxes, each with 4 app icons, basically categorized into these default boxes of apps that you would typically use. And I think, honestly, the app library having these 12 different, eight different, however many there are, categories that they're automatically, I think they're based on the app store categories, actually, that they're automatically grouping these apps into. And the fact that each one of these boxes gives you 3 apps, I imagine that mathematically 99% of the apps you could be going to look for is going to be one of those 3 apps that it's featuring in each one of these boxes. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
I imagine that, almost every time you're going into the app library, you're going to see the app that you want immediately right there in front of you, right? And then if you don't see it, then you're a tap away from either the list or a tap away from looking through all of the apps that Apple has automatically put in that category. And I think that Google was actually the first to do this with those 5 app suggestions in the Pixel launcher. But I think that in the next version, I think that we're just going to see them double down on that. And actually, if anyone remembers, it might have been 30 or 40 episodes ago, but I remember talking on the podcast about how I think that Apple or Google really needs to, man, we cannot get those straight today. No. Google really needs to double down on these machine learning intelligent suggestions, because I think that if they got them good enough, it could get to the point where they always know exactly which app you're going to use next, right? Mm-hmm. With enough data and enough training, right? Like over the course of using your phone for a month or two, and I've noticed that as someone who uses iOS relatively often, where Apple has mastered this is in the Siri suggestions. When you pull down on the home screen, those Siri suggestions, I've actually tested this out like a week or two ago, because I was just curious because I noticed how good it was. I tried to use my phone for an entire day, and instead of scrolling through the app pages, I intentionally just pulled down on the home screen to see if the Siri suggestion, those four apps at the top, to see if the app I was going to use was in the list. And I tried it, and I think I had about 20 in that day. I had 20 times where I was going to look for an app, and I think like 16 of them, the app I was going to use was in one of those four Siri suggestions. So I don't know. I mean, I think Apple's gotten really good at this. I think Google's really gotten really good at this. And I think that's kind of the big term or the big picture vision for where the app drawer is going to go. I would not be surprised.
I do have to add that as of Android 11 beta 1, the developer previews and betas, there's been a bit of a regression in that swipe up to see the apps, to see your frequently used apps. If you swipe up on the app drawer, you can still see your five most recently used apps. But Google removed it from the recent multitasking view. And that has been a thing that's I've missed greatly. So I'm not sure if that's the design, the direction for Android 11, and we'll see a bigger prominence in Android 12. But the big thing that Google wants to do is this idea of having your dock, the five icons that are always docked and always visible, to have those become suggestions. And I use all of the five apps there, and I think most people might as well. So I don't know how they're going to fit those smarts in the current design. But yeah, it's always something to keep innovating on.
Sure. Yeah, I don't know what it's going to look like, but I think that feels like the general direction that smartphone UX is going. And I think I feel like this is usually how it works. Google beats Apple to something fundamental, and then Apple does what Google invented, or quote unquote invented. They do it in a way that is more user-friendly or more polished. And then Google comes after and then basically arrives at the same conclusion that Apple reached with the thing that Google invented. That feels like the pattern that works itself out very, very often. And so a lot of the time with the Pixel, we've been seeing so many things that it's like, oh, well, Google's just copying Apple. Well, you know, Google was the one that introduced the fundamental feature that Apple iterated on, and now Google is iterating on Apple's iteration. So it's you can't really give anyone credit for being the brainchild of any of these things, because it's so these platforms are so mature and these features are being so rapidly iterated on by both companies that it's almost impossible to distinguish who's innovating or who's inventing what. Speaking of that, pretty much every other feature that Apple announced with iOS 14 is pretty much that, it's like little minor things that Google maybe did first that Apple's now doing, or that, you know, Google invented, or they were the first to introduce a small, the grain of the idea, and then Apple's iterating on it. And then those include, you know, picture in picture. That's something that Android's had for a while. Siri, some Siri changes. Siri is slightly less sucky with iOS 14. So great. Google Translate. Now Apple's doing their own first party Translate app. App Clips, which what are your thoughts on App Clips?
Actually, that's the biggest thing that I think is a prime example of Google doing something first, Apple innovating on it and being able to scale it, and then Google coming back and refining their approach. So App Clips, the way that Apple presented it is there's a real physical component to what Apple introduced. So they have this idea of a parking meter. So you are the parking meter, and you have to pay, and you want to pay with your phone because you don't want to use your credit card or whatever. And so there will be these circular QR codes that you can scan, and it'll immediately offer to launch this app clip, which is a, in the purposes of the parking app, is a parking meter app where all you have to do, all you can do is just pay. So it completes the Apple Pay transaction, this integration with that, and you just get the experience and you will be notified. The app, that app clip can notify you when you're running, when your the meter is almost out and all that stuff in a compact 10 megabyte app experience solely for this function. And this is, for me anyways, it's super interesting in how it's like bridging the real world with the digital in an interactivity that's more, so much more intuitive than using URLs and that kind of stuff, and even and taking QR codes to another level. So Google's comparison is instant apps, but I've instant apps. I think that was 2 years ago, or even last year. Time is a circle. Anyways, so instant apps, they have, to me, they've always felt more digital. Somebody sends you a link to, I don't know, let's say Amazon. I know Amazon isn't doing this. So let's say Amazon. Somebody sends you an Amazon link, and you can immediately launch that product page from Amazon in a native app-like experience. You immediately get served that from the URL. And basically, it's the same concept of you being able to interact with the store using a more native experience that's better than the web and has features like, let's say, Google Pay integration. So this is what, this is the two different approaches. And I don't think that on Android, it's really gotten that much adoption, because instant, another way that Google has tried to push instant apps is in the Play Store, letting you demo an app before downloading. I think the Google Travels app, before it was deprecated, was an example of you being able to try to and get an instant app experience. They're also trying to do that with games. So it's a very digital approach from Google. But I think that what Apple has, the thing that Apple is going to cleverly do and popularize is the idea of using instant apps for these physical interactions in the world.
Yeah, I think the only question I have is, why did they have to invent their own code system for this? I think our Jordan Vasquez, a listener of the podcast who's listening right now live on YouTube, he commented, hooray, proprietary QR codes. And I feel like, I don't know, I feel like it's not, I mean, why is this necessary? I can see why it's necessary for the Apple Watch, for example, to have what is essentially a proprietary QR code for doing that setup pairing process, but why does this need to be something proprietary? I don't know. I mean, is there an obvious functionality here that a QR code would not be? I mean, Apple could easily loop this into the camera app somehow, and
it's 100,000% branding, isn't it? Because for whatever reason, all QR codes are squares, and
yeah,
Apple needs to distinguish itself. But right. Yeah, it should be an open standard, because. Yeah, I don't know if Google and Apple have had discussions, but if Google is taking instant apps in that same direction as them, they would do well to consolidate.
Yeah, it feels like yet another silly ecosystem lock-in thing, because let's go to the logical conclusion. Let's say that that's pretty much where Google goes with instant apps as well. We would have to, I mean, every Bird scooter on every corner of San Diego is going to have both an Apple proprietary code and an Android proprietary code. They already have, I'm pretty sure they all already have QR codes on them. I don't know. It seems odd to me and unnecessary, but yeah, that'll be our easy, quick Apple critique of the day. I think it's likely that like Android or Google is going to go in a similar direction with this, because I don't know if instant apps has had really much adoption. And I think that that friction point, I think it's a very real friction point when you're out and about and you want to quickly enter your card info, you want to use that scooter, you want to pick up that bike or whatever. Like, these are very everyday
friction
for smartphone users. You know, if you don't already have, like, currently the workflow for using a Bird scooter is like, you have to download the app, you have to scan the QR code on the scooter, you have to stand there and enter your card information directly into the Bird app. You know, it's like, it's a 5 to 10 minute experience. And that seems to be the thing that Apple is particularly targeting with this. And I think Google would be smart to realize that that is also a friction point that instant apps could quickly alleviate, and do a similar thing. So.
And a minor historical note, Google has tried doing this for ages with their like Bluetooth beacons and NFC, but mostly Bluetooth. Right. They've tried to push this for years and years with Nearby, and it really never took off. They had like vending machines with Bluetooth beacons, but it eventually ended because Bluetooth jacked, like, people putting up beacons everywhere that can ping your phone or like actively show that they're around. It's just annoying. And
yeah,
the sad dream of those beacons just ended.
Yeah. Well, I think we can move on, but I guess some of the other things that are just coming to iOS now, home activity zones, and
Facebook copy of Nest.
Pretty much. CarPlay is getting backgrounds. Does Android Auto have backgrounds?
No, and our Ben Schoen is very excited about this, being able to customize the background.
Yeah, and it seems likely this is another one of those cases where if Android Auto doesn't have it yet, you know, the next major release of Android Auto, or I guess Google Auto is probably what it'll be called.
probably
support some really pretty pixel wallpapers or something. Yeah, weather's getting those dark sky features, which is a bummer. Rip dark sky for Android. And then finally, the last fundamental Android thing that's also been a very early days discussion or decision that Google made was the ability to set default apps for a variety of categories. Apple is now opening it up to where you can select your default browser and email apps. So that's a big deal. I don't know. This feels like one of those things that's been one of the deal breakers that's kept some people on Android that would otherwise want to switch to iPhone.
So email, big thing. Apple Mail handles email weirdly. But the browser thing is, yeah, it's good. But again, they're skins. Everybody's basically skinning. Since you can't run your own browser engines, you have to use Apple's WebKit. But again, it's cool. It's very good to be able to access your bookmarks from the Google ecosystem and all that. But at the same time, it's at a high level. You're basically just skinning the browser. So yeah, they're starting with Mail and the web.
Yeah, and MKBHD actually had a chat with Craig Federighi on his YouTube channel. You should go check that out. It's a pretty interesting interview because Apple doesn't usually answer user or customer question feedbacks like this when it comes to their major software launches. And Craig actually mentioned that, or I should say Marquez mentioned that he would be interested in being able to set Google Maps as his default map app. It seems like Maps is that third category that definitely Apple could have done here pretty easily, but they didn't the reason that the Apple Maps, they're trying to rectify half a decade of Apple Maps being behind and finally lately starting to kind of catch up with Google Maps. In many ways. And so the last thing they want is everyone just immediately defaulting all of their map apps to Google Maps and losing any traction.
Yeah. And the other problem with that, it's not like there's a bustling ecosystem of like, it's Google Maps.
Waze,
it's also Google. Like, there's no third party app developer, indie developer thing that is demanding a Maps thing. So I don't think Apple ever acquiesced.
I'm pretty sure there's a Garmin.
Oh, man.
I don't know. One of these GPS companies, I'm pretty sure, has some really, really bad navigation apps. But yeah. So I don't. Yeah, it seems like that's definitely like Apple opening the gates for people to choose either Apple Maps or Google Maps. Which, if they have control over that, they're probably not going to just allow people to do that. Although this definitely seems like one of those things where they're trying to virtue signal the antitrust gods.
Yes.
And gain some peace on that front, but who knows? I guess browser and email is a good enough start. Craig also did mention that they're going to be pretty selective about which browsers and email clients will be able to do this. So you can't just, they're locking it down so that not any app can claim to be a browser or an email client, and only the biggest ones or only the most notable ones would be able to do this. Probably to prevent that user experience from becoming someone who doesn't know how to use their phone being hijacked into a crappy game as their default browser or something. So,
well, yeah.
So yeah, that's everything that Apple did with iOS this week, and there was plenty of other things that they did with iPadOS and watchOS and macOS, but we're not going to get into that on this show, I don't think. Maybe in the future. On Google's part, they actually seem to take this week as a little bit of an opportunity to launch some stuff that probably would have been Google I.O. material, you think?
Oh, absolutely. Google Photos, last month celebrated its fifth anniversary, and they would have definitely talked that up on stage as it was announced 5 years ago at I.O. So yeah, there's a Google Photos design. We've been tracking this for quite a while. It's gone through some permutations, but the final design they centered on is a three-tab bottom bar with no navigation drawer. So it's interesting what they're prioritizing in this main navigation. So yeah, you have Photos, you have your library, but the center tab is now Search, which makes a lot of sense to emphasize what Google Photos is so good at. But also because they have this brilliant new Maps view where you can view your photos against the map, against the background. And of course, there have been apps that have done this in the past, but it's now integrated and it's really well done, this Photos view. It's not widely rolled out on Android, but on Google, on iOS, it's pretty much there. It's coming within the next week. But with the Maps feature, you get this gorgeous heat map of where you've taken the most photos. And I think it's a very clever effect to just simply browse. And as you go back in time, the pin on the map goes, jumps from place to place. And it's very well done.
Yeah, this is another one of those cases where Google definitely is pulling all of whatever data, how people have been using Google Photos over the last 5 years. 5 years is a pretty good sample size for an app like this. And I'm sure they have plenty of data to figure out what people are doing, what the primary functions are. I think obviously they found a lot of success with this feature that lets you time travel basically, and it's stories for your own memories. And I think that they obviously found out that was a very popular feature. I mean, I know my own family that use Google Photos that I've personally converted to Google Photos have very often, you know, sent me messages on, you know, various messaging platforms or whatever with like, hey, look at this picture of us from 2 years ago. I found it in Google Photos. And it's very popular. It's basically, what was that app called? It was a third party app that tied into all your social media platform, TimeHop. It's basically hijacked.
Oh, I missed TimeHop.
Yeah, it's basically a copy of TimeHop. TimeHop obviously has fallen off. It's not as popular anymore. I don't know if anyone uses TimeHop anymore. I very rarely see TimeHop screenshots. But yeah, it's basically that. And they made that bigger, more prominent. And so that makes total sense. And they also are doing like the for you suggestions are now up there, or where's the for you stuff now?
Yeah, so it's integrated with the memories feature, which is
right
bigger and given more emphasis. It's these cards instead of circles at the top of the photos feed. So that's where they're putting like highlights and memories all the creations, all those custom creations that Google makes, all those memory reminders. So it's interesting how they're just putting all their all suggestions, which, yeah, it's good to not have another feed of this kind of stuff. So yeah, I'm just curious in the implementation of how they end up doing that.
Yeah, I would just imagine that there weren't many people using the For You tab. I know I don't.
It's useful for the past, for the past stuff. But as you were saying, it's basically the same feature,
right?
Yeah, it's memories.
The search stuff being front and center makes total sense, as you mentioned, because that's pretty much what makes Google Photos so good. The logo's awful.
That's bold.
Not accepting any comments. No, I mean it's very let's condense this icon into its most fundamental form, and that means what looks like an icon that a 12-year-old could have made in Windows Paint, and you know, whatever.
Yeah, well, it's basically. I mean, it's modern. Let's put it that way. And if not to bring up the whole Maps fiasco, I mean the Maps icon fiasco, which took a perfectly beautiful icon that spanned the entire icon shape and make it a pin against white background, was a horrendous decision. But back on track here, it's. Yeah, it looks like a pinwheel, I guess. Though when was the last time you used a pinwheel? I digress again. But
it's very arbitrary.
It doesn't look like Slack.
It's like when the original iOS photo app was a sunflower. It's like, is this a stereotype of photographers, that photographers are just obsessed with taking photos of sunflowers? Is that just inherent to the human experience that we associate sunflowers with photography? It's just
but at the same time, look at the new Apple Photos icon. It's, what is that supposed to be?
Yeah, I don't know. It's supposed to be an abstract flower,
I think.
It's like they kind of retained some of the floral aspect, but they condensed it down to being a representation of the rainbow or the prism of colors that hit our eyes, and they put those two ideas together into something that's very, I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of that one either. I never have been. That one hasn't changed since iOS 7, and I don't understand it very much either.
So yeah, back to the Google Photos icon. It's my problem. I like the shape. I think the colors are too simple, but that's the trend that Google's going with everything. So sure, whatever. I don't like it because it's too flat. It looks too much like four semicircles, though it has curved corners, as Dylan pointed out. But it's just too flat. There's no personality to it.
Yeah, I think this is a whole other conversation, but I think that this launch of this Google Photos icon is like, I don't know. I feel like all of Google's revamped icons, which are now all white backgrounds with Google colors on top, I think that this is like Google's iOS 7 moment where they stripped all of their branding down to the most basic form. And now now that all of their products have been stripped down to these Google color identities, they're hopefully going to get a little bit of personality back in the coming years.
Are they?
I mean, they're not going to be this way forever. They have to change eventually. We're not going to have the same Google Photos app in 10 years. I don't think.
But that's just what they went away from. Like, it would literally be a circle, because then the next logical step to add back personality is to do layers. And like go back to material.
This is a common thing with design, and where you know you kind of strip things down to being the most core essence of what it is, and then you allow an iteration of it, you know, to bring back the character. I mean, that's exactly what we've seen with iOS 7. It was like, iOS 7, Ive and Alan Dye, they stripped all of this identity down to the very core basics of what they wanted to convey with this branding or this, with the iconography. And now, since then, all of those icons have gained back their character, I think, in one way or another. I mean, maybe Photos is the one exception. But I mean, if you look at the calculator app on iOS, and there's plenty of examples where these apps were stripped to nothing and then they kind of got to put their clothes back on. And I think, to me, that's what this whole thing feels like with Google going to white backgrounds and all their apps. I don't think it's a long-term solution. I think it's just them trying to, I think there's definitely been an initiative across the whole company ever since the Material Theme initiative started with Material Design, that they're unifying the branding across all of their first party Google products, because they've all kind of been a shit show for 10 years. And this was them kind of just stripping everything down to the core of what it means to be a Google branded product. And I hope I'm right and that these icons are going to get some character back, but who knows?
Yeah.
It feels like a reset to me. I think that's pretty common, because it's a lot easier to then move forward if you can get everything back to what the core fundamental starting point is, rather than try and orchestrate some kind of vision across everything before you have that consistency. So I don't know. I'm hopeful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Picky me.
Everybody likes the design.
Speaking of, I don't know, I don't have a good transition here, but Google is apparently acquiring North, which is our final story for the show today. And North, for those that don't know, was a company by the name of, what were they previously called? I forgot.
Thalmic Labs.
Thalmic Labs, yes. They're a Canadian startup, pretty much the sweetheart of the Canadian startup space for the last several years. They kind of got their name originally in the wearables space, or the wearables. They rode the wearables wave, I guess, with their Mayo armband. And then they kind of transitioned into AR glasses somehow. I don't really know the story of how that happened, but it did. And now apparently they're being bought up by Google, and apparently a dollar amount they're being bought up for is pretty much exactly how much debt they've taken on.
Yeah.
So it seems like they've struggled a lot over the last several years, and Google is now stepping in to do what seems to me, I mean, do you have a different take on this? Do you think that, or do you think, and my take on it is that this is definitely an IP grab. It seems like North has acquired a lot of intellectual property surrounding augmented reality. I think for those that don't know, Intel's glasses were a thing. And Intel had a lot of IP, and North bought that from Intel. So with that acquisition, I think a lot of people were like, oh, cool, that means that North might actually launch a product. And it looks like they're going to further pass that IP on to Google. So I think that's probably the fundamental reason this acquisition's happening, I would guess.
Adam Haya, as you mentioned.
And yeah, that's the side effect, is that maybe a good portion of these people are willing to relocate, or are willing, does Google, I mean, where is this company based in Toronto, or I forget exactly where.
It's the Blackberry, Ontario, right? Is that?
Okay. That's what,
maybe not. Well,
Ontario. Yeah. Not a city. I'm trying to.
A region.
City.
Waterloo, maybe.
Waterloo. Okay. That sounds right. I don't think Google, does Google have a campus in Waterloo?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't think so. They have this. They're really building up in Canada, so they have space for them.
Yeah. Well, whatever the case, it seems likely that an acquihire is part of this deal. I'm sure there's lots of talent that they'd love to have.
Half full, what though?
I think Google has to do what.
Do they have already?
Do they have what? Do they have an AR product?
Uh-huh. Do they? Do they
have one? I don't think so. I mean, I think if they did, we would know about it. But I think that they're probably feeling the heat of the reality that they were the ones that started this whole conversation. And Apple's going to step in and steal and take their lunch. Well, they don't really have lunch. They have like some Cheez-Its they left on the floor. Like that's what Apple's going to take.
So yeah, I think this conversation requires a brief recap into Google's AR history, unfortunately. So Google Glass, they tried that. The Explorer edition did not fail. It failed, and they wound that down to what is Enterprise edition. In between that, they got really into phone-based VR with Daydream. And they did a lot. Then they eventually pushed standalone Daydream, standalone headsets. But for all intents and purposes, they are ending that. The Pixel 4 does not support Daydream. They're open sourcing Cardboard to give to the community, which is their Cardboard VR viewers. And from the hardware perspective, it does very much seem like they have no immediate plans, because last year at I.O., their AR and VR division basically said they are in deep R&D right now. They're working on the building blocks for augmented reality. And there are two... that can be interpreted in a variety of ways. Those building blocks could basically be Google Lens and visual search and all that kind of stuff. And or it could be hardware. But nothing about their hardware plans for augmented reality glasses has leaked. And this is coming at a time when Apple is rumored to be just 2-3 years out from getting a headset out. And it's so, my personal thing is that AR has a hardware problem. Nobody has managed to shrink the display tech yet. And yeah. I don't know if Google is trying to do that in-house, or whether they're just hope somebody else does it and like take a real Android approach. Because at the end of the day, consumer wearable AR is going to be won by whoever controls the miniaturization of the technology. And if Apple does it completely in-house, that's going to be a long time until everybody else catches up and like makes the Android OEM model impossible.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think at this point, all of Google's significant expensive hardware R&D is all happening inside of Rick's made by Google hardware division. I think that's the only place in the company where that's happening. At least, I mean, if there is that kind of thing happening elsewhere, I don't know where it is. So, I mean, we talk about Clay Bavor, and he's been overseeing this AR VR group for a while, which included Daydream to some degree before Daydream kind of got the axe. I think that if Google was doing AR hardware, a significant AR hardware initiative, I mean, obviously, it would be in the Skunkworks-y innovate R&D stage right now. And so if it is happening, it might not have leaked. But that would be a long shot, I think, because Google's hardware division is particularly leaky. Even if it was a small, internal initiative. But the thing is, if it is a small internal initiative, that means it's probably not enough to go up against what's the flood of hardware Apple, that's coming from Apple.
And the rumor that they have 1,000 people working on it.
Exactly. So, like, it seems very clear that if Google is working on some kind of AR hardware of their own, it's not anywhere near the same scale as what Apple is doing. I mean, I'd love to be proven wrong. And if you if you're privy to any information on this, feel free to let me know if I am wrong. I'd love to hear it. But I think it's more likely that for now they're focused on the software side of things. And I just think that they're probably accepting that they're not going to be able to foot the bill for what it, or even acquire the talent for what it would be to go up against this project or projects, plural, at Apple that have been in R&D for what? Probably 5 years now. I mean, all of these AR projects, yeah, 5, maybe even 10 years. I would imagine that going back to even maybe before the original Apple Watch was announced, Apple has had some amount of R&D going into AR hardware. And so Google is just, when they decided to just funnel all of the Google Glass hardware innovation or initiative R&D into X, and then now back into Google, whatever, it's all pointless.
Yeah.
The rules are made up and the points don't matter at Google when it comes to which division is doing what. But yeah, I think when they made the decision to move Glass to X and kind of say, oh, we're just going to let this be this enterprise thing, when they decided that instead of let's double down and really pour money into turning Glass into something that's going to be a major consumer product in 5 to 10 years, which is what Apple was doing whenever Google was fiddling around with Glass
publicly.
Right. Exactly. I think that was when Google made the decision that they were not going to be able to go up against Apple in the way that people are probably hoping they would, or at least expecting they would, given their history with Glass. That's not to say they can't at one point launch something or do something that will be comparable. I mean, it's clear that Google has some degree. I mean, they've got plenty of talent now working on smartphones and plenty of other hardware, and they've just acquired North, which is going to be a whole team of talent that's been working on smart glass hardware for a long time, and the intellectual property related to that, not to mention Fitbit, is all other team of talent that they've recently acquired. So, I mean, I think that in the 5 year span, it's not impossible to imagine that Google is going to be able to do something in this space, in the hardware side of this space. So I would not say personally that this is going to be a situation where Google just tries to do Android again and just lets all their partners do hardware. But
yeah,
I think they're behind. That's all.
Yeah. I was about to ask you that Samsung question. Sorry. Android question. Well, Freudian slip there.
Well, it is a Samsung question.
Yeah, because they're the last ones doing it. They're the biggest players. And I don't know if I see LG or Sony getting into this, but for all intents and purposes, it would be Samsung. So anyways, my question was, what model is Google going to take? Is this going to be an Android model where they supply the operating system and everybody else supplies the hardware? Or is this going to be, because smart glasses is a completely brand new opportunity to reinvent reinvent the customer relationship, because Apple is going to offer an end-to-end experience. But Google, they could also offer an end-to-end experience, or they could go the OEM model where they just offer they offer the underlying operating system, but more importantly, they offer the key services like the power of Google Search as through Google Lens. So it's unclear the model that any of this is going to shape. But I would have thought that Android is obviously big and they won the smartphone space in terms of pure numbers, but at the same time, smart glasses could have been an opportunity for Google to take a different approach where they own the whole end-to-end experience with consumers.
Yeah, I think that's going to be I think the whole story of this thing is going to be it just feels like what we were talking about earlier at the top of the show, actually, this is the perfect way to put a bow on this, a neat little bow, is that on the software side of things, Google usually is the one that comes out with the first,
absolutely,
the first nugget of an innovation or an idea, and then they kind of just let other people develop that into something that's actually a good end user experience that's been fleshed out and user tested,
absolutely,
and then after that happens, then they come back and they say us too. And yeah, I feel like that's
innovation.
it seems to be what has and is happening. It's a shame. That seems to be what's happening with the AR hardware, is that they were clearly the first ones out of the gate with something that was
vaguely
reminiscent of what we envision consumer AR hardware would look like, but it just wasn't anywhere close to actually being something that anyone would actually want to use, and throwing it out in the world proved that very quickly. And now it seems like other companies, Apple, maybe Samsung, are going to pick up that idea, and they actually have the resources and the time and the conviction to do it in a certain way that actually makes sense for consumers. And then sadly, the way the story ends is that Google's late to the game, like they are with the Pixel, and like they would be if they launched a Pixel Watch this year, and like they were with the Pixel Buds, where they're going to launch something that's good, but it's going to miss out on what could have been a great opportunity if they had committed to something out of principle rather than out of the A/B testing optimizing for whether or not optimizing for traction, basically. Like they saw glass and they're like, well, this isn't growing exponentially, and then they just dragged it to the trash. You know, it's like, well, there's something here to fundamentally commit to, and they just didn't. It doesn't seem.
Yeah, Google absolutely is an innovative company, but innovation is an experience, isn't offering the experience, the UX of how to use something. And more often than not, it's Apple that gets the UX down, that has that vision for how people might want to use computers, or how they want to dictate.
Yeah, and it also seems like they intensively test before they actually, like they test to see that something is objectively good before launching it out into the world. And yeah, so not to say that Google never does that. It just is very clear on the spectrum of throw things out, A/B test, and optimize for what happens to get traction, and pour more fuel on the fires that happen to grow, versus an execution of conviction and discernment. You know, it seems clear that Google is on one end of that spectrum and Apple's on the other. Not to say that one's better than the other, but that's just the state of these companies.
And now that you, and I guess just to bring this back to North and their focals, North has been teasing a Focals 2.0, and you can acquire your way to a market, but at the same time, if they just go with Focals, that doesn't seem very opinionated. That doesn't seem like they have a vision that they wanted to achieve. I know maybe they saw something they really liked in Focals 2.0, but to the idea that this is just an acquihire and patents.
Yeah, the question is, can or will? I mean, this is really the alternative to this just being patents and acquire. In my view, the alternative is that they let North launch whatever they're about to launch, and they use that as the springboard, so to speak, to get Google back into developing their own AR hardware, and that would allow them to learn from something that they're not directly attributing to the Google brand, whereas you and I would still know what's actually going on behind the scenes, but most people wouldn't. To most people, it would just be North 2.0, I think. And so,
yeah,
I see that as a possibility, but that seems unlikely to me, given that 2.0 or whatever North 2.0 is, it hasn't launched, and it doesn't seem like it's close to launching. And I don't know if that's the direction that Google would want to go, risking the PR. You know, Google failed glass again. You know, like I could see that being the headline.
And actually, this kind of ties in with Fitbit in a way, because it's Fitbit and North to a lesser degree. They have these existing products, and Google has to find a way to, if they do buy them, if the Fitbit deal closes, they have to find a way to Google-fy it. And if it's just adding assistants on both of these products or adding Google Lens, however, that would work on such a constrained device. That's not opinionated. That doesn't scream that you have a vision for how this stuff works. It just speaks to you want to get your services and everything. And that's very different from offering a vision of the future.
Yeah. Well, I think that conversation is a pretty good way to end the show.
Yeah.
Sorry for all the Apple discussion today. If you want to hear about things that are not related to all of Apple's major WWDC announcements, be sure to tune in next week. We'll probably have a show that does not center around comparing the strengths and weaknesses of the two most important, in my opinion, firms in the Bay Area. Well, really in the world, because these companies aren't really centered in California anymore. And seems like that's going to be even more the case in a remote working world post-COVID. The unprecedented world that has now become precedented because it doesn't seem to be going away. So thanks for tuning in, everybody. We really appreciate you listening to the show. We record this podcast every week. We're considering, as I mentioned at the top of the show, going to a strictly scheduled weekly podcast. We kind of just let things go where they go because sometimes, I mean, for instance, if we hadn't waited till today to have the show, we wouldn't have had North to talk about this afternoon. So there's pros and cons to each, but if you strongly feel like you would benefit from having this show strictly scheduled at a certain time every week, be sure to let us know. You can email us at tips@9to5gg.com for any feedback on the show you have. If you can, please leave us some feedback or a review on Apple Podcasts. 5 stars over there would do us a lot of good. If you enjoy the show, and you can listen to us on all your favorite podcasting platforms, such as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and directly you can download the podcast at 9to5google.com. Thanks for tuning in, as always. Thanks to Abner for joining me, and we'll see you next week on Alphabet Scoop.
Bye.